The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And
the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice
with specialties in unconscious bias,
leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend.
More at thedagobagroup.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union,
helping their members save money through free checking accounts
and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union,
encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Since the attacks in Paris, the question of how to engage ISIS in Syria has been front and center. Underlying that debate is the changing nature of America's national security state. We're exploring that shift in strategy and the nature of America's fighting force today. Later in the show, we'll talk about brain drain among active duty military and recruits. But first, where at least $3 billion in the defense budget is going today, America's colleges and universities, some you've heard of and some you haven't. William Arkin is an author, a journalist, a former U.S. soldier, and national security advisor to Vice News. Together with Alexa O'Brien, he investigated and ranked the 100 most militarized universities in America for Vice News. And he joins us now on the line to talk about which schools profit the most from these significant investments. William Arkin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much for having me on.
So the most militarized evokes quite a picture. What did you mean by using this term?
Well, we actually had a lot of discussion as to whether or not this was the proper term, because what we're really talking about here are the schools that provide the most students who ultimately get employed by the intelligence community and the national security community. We started with a list of 90,000 people who were working in the intelligence community and the national security community. And from that, we were able to derive where they went to school, where they had received degrees from, and when. And then we started to calculate which were the most prevalent schools, and it didn't seem to us like it was a meaningful analysis at first, but finally, once we started crunching the numbers, we realized that it revealed a lot of surprises, and it revealed a lot about the nature of the intelligence community. Now, are these the most militarized universities in the sense that you think of when you think of guns and sort of police state, if you will? Maybe not. But we also say in our article that militarized means the new military, and the new military is so oriented towards cybersecurity and so oriented towards information technology that, in fact, when you look at the people who are actually working in the intelligence community today coming out of these schools, those are the predominant degrees that they're getting.
And how many people are you talking about?
There are 1.4 million Americans who have top secret clearances. So we had a data set of 90,000. It's about 6% of the total. And we looked at the resumes of those 90,000 people, and we then started to calculate which schools they went to. And we determined that the top 10 schools were the University of Maryland first, which makes sense. It has both proximity to Washington, D.C., and also has a long history with the U.S. military. After that, we found out that the next two schools on the list were American Military University and the University of Phoenix, both online for-profit schools. And overall, in the top 100, there were 20 online schools that were most prevalent amongst the degrees that were earned by people who worked in the intelligence community. Then there were a set of schools that were very heavily invested in defense research, and that represented 17 of the top 100. And not without irony, of the $3 billion or so dollars that these universities overall get from the Defense Department every year, the top 10 schools on our list get two-thirds of that money. Hmm. So that's $2 billion just going to 10 schools. Johns Hopkins, Georgia Tech, MIT, Penn State, University of Maryland again, University of Texas at Austin, USC, Stanford, University of Washington, and Texas A&M. And then we looked at the schools that had new programs which had been created since 9/11.
All right, so let's dig into some of these things you've just laid out. So you mentioned, you know, some like MIT, Carnegie Mellon have had long relationship with the government and defense contractors, but they're at 27 and 47 respectively. So who are some of these new players that are emerging?
Well, the new players are mostly the online schools. Mm-hmm. And those, again, constitute 20 of the 100. Some of these schools didn't even exist before 9/11.
I had never heard of Cochise College, which is at number 6,
right,
or Excelsior, Central Texas. I mean, have these just popped up, and are they seizing on an opportunity and what sounds like a gravy train?
Well, it is a gravy train to some degree in the sense that certainly this is a valuable student body. And I mean that in the sense that the U.S. government largely pays their tuition, either through tuition assistance that's provided by the government to people who are on active duty or will work for the government, or GI Bill for veterans. But really, what we see, Cochise College, Excelsior College, Central Texas College, even to some degree Villanova University, each of them has a specific reason why they are so prevalent in this world. So Cochise College, for instance, sits outside of the largest Army Intelligence Training Center in the U.S. in Fort Huachuca, Arizona. And Excelsior College is the favored school for law enforcement people to get their degrees in criminology and forensics. It's in Albany, New York. And Villanova University, in a funny way, we were thinking, well, why is this school even on the list? And yet when we looked at the resumes and the backgrounds of the people who had graduated from there, we saw that almost all of them had gone to the business school and almost all of them had studied some subject area having to do with contracting or project management. So in fact, all of the people in the intelligence community who do the black budget and do contracting and do all the paperwork, if you will, seem to be going to school at Villanova and getting their master's there.
So is the government directly funding the colleges or funding the student tuitions, or is it a mix?
No, it's a mix, but the government is definitely mostly funding the tuition. So the Department of Defense has an active tuition assistance program for those who are on active duty, and the GI Bill, of course, dispenses somewhere on the order of about $15 billion a year to universities and colleges across America. It is, you know, for the online schools, particularly for the ones that have been controversial or have been involved in issues associated with recruiting or with low graduation rates and usury. University of Phoenix is
yes.
One, and
yeah.
There's certainly been a lot of stories about other schools. These schools, I think, are really taking advantage of two things. One, the explosion of distance learning, if you will, online mm-hmm. capable learning. And then the second is the growth of the intelligence community and the law enforcement community post 9/11 and the bureaucratic requirement for these people to be trained. So if you think about it, 9/11 sort of occurred at the cusp of the information era. It occurred at a time when there was an explosion of information and certainly then therefore an explosion of cybersecurity. And what we saw was that the government itself didn't really have the background or the means to train people, so they contracted out the training. They contracted out the education, and some schools took advantage of it. And not just, you know, schools of poor repute. Some of the schools on our list, there are some Ivy League schools on our list, mm-hmm. University of Pennsylvania, Cornell, Harvard University. There are some high-class schools on our list, even in the top 10, Georgetown University or Penn State. And so I don't think that you can say that people necessarily all go to bad schools. I'm saying that you have a combination of reasons why these schools particularly appear on the list, and it's very distinct. I can almost tell you for each school why it is popular with people in the military.
When you think of the most militarized colleges and universities in America, maybe you think of marching ROTC students in the middle of the quad. Well, William Arkin is with us. He has co-authored a Vice News investigation into how much money the U.S. government is pouring into institutes of higher learning, especially since 9/11, when Homeland Security degrees became available. Interested, you know, if the government is funding them, this represents an investment. So what are they majoring in? Is there any kind of, did you stack that up?
We did. We thought to ourselves, okay, well, is there some trend that we can identify that clearly shows us what people are studying? And without a doubt, information sciences and information technology is number one, and not just number one, but number one to the point of view that it's almost twice the size of number two. And number two is systems engineering, which is more or less IT as well. And so you don't get down until, I think, number nine of the most popular majors amongst people in this group of 90,000 before you get to political science. Mm. And if you're looking for some kind of a sign that people have been attracted to the study of Middle Eastern studies or Near Eastern studies or Arabic, you'd have to go down into the small percentages. Less than 80 people have degrees in Middle Eastern studies. There are fewer than 1,000 people in our overall database who speak Arabic, and of those 1,000, 600 of them are Arab Americans who are native speakers. So really the changes that we expected to happen after 9/11, this sort of boots on the ground transition of the intelligence community from the remote warfare of the 1990s to a sort of more human intelligence and a more cultural understanding, it doesn't seem to have happened, at least on the education side. And to some degree, I think that helps us to understand why we still seem to be so ignorant and surprised when events occur in the Middle East that we don't understand what's going on.
Well, it seems to me that this would make sense if you've got people set up to process intelligence. I mean, intelligence on the ground has been notoriously weak and blamed for bungles from Baghdad to Benghazi. Now, shouldn't this be something the U.S. relies more on than boots on the ground? Isn't this a smart strategy for a cyber warfare future?
The answer is clearly yes, but it's kind of like the amateur answer, because when you actually look at the jobs that these people have, and again, we have the resumes of these 90,000 people who work in the intelligence community, most of them are operating software. Most of them are processing what's being collected. Most of them are involved in moving that material and in storing that material and processing that material. So what we found with Edward Snowden, what we find with all of these incidents when they occur, is that the United States has an abundance of data. It has an abundance of information. Where we are weak is in analyzing that information and making sense of the world and providing warning to the United States government, which is the ultimate responsibility of the intelligence community. And so the information that we're talking about is not information necessarily about the culture of the countries that we're fighting in, not necessarily the language of the countries we're fighting in. It's processing the data from satellites, from drones, from intercepts, from cyber warfare. And that, as we well know, is a massive amount of information that tends to overwhelm the intelligence world. And so here, I think we've identified a symptom, which is that we've become so overwhelmed by the information that we have needed to build up this gigantic cadre just to run the machine. And what we failed to do post 9/11, what we told ourselves we would do post 9/11, which is to make the intelligence community less technical and more human, to make our foreign policy more boots on the ground and less remote, has actually not happened.
I'm also wondering, given the mistrust of the national security state spying on its own citizens, is there a fear that all of these intelligence processors that are being graduated from American universities and colleges are going to be spying not on those in other countries, but on us?
Well, we definitely see the development of a skill set and a capability within the United States that has been led by the military, the intelligence community, and Homeland Security apparatus. And so now we see hundreds of thousands of veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, of the war on terrorism, moving on to the universities and then moving on into civilian life. What we also at the same time see is police organizations which are increasingly becoming more focused on the collection of intelligence. And whether that means in a place like New Hampshire increasing the amounts of license plate readers or drones or the networking of databases amongst even local police departments to be able to access federal information, all of that necessitates an IT infrastructure and a skill set, which is not what you normally associate with what you think about when you think about the police. And so you do see this migration occurring. There's definitely no question that military people are heavily represented amongst the law enforcement agencies of the United States domestically. And their orientation towards data and their orientation towards intelligence will probably see the bigger impact in the next decade as the skills that they learned in the military and in the intelligence community are then proliferated into local police.
Bill Arkin, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me on.
William Arkin, he's an author and a journalist and a blogger and Vice News national security helper. He is the co-author with Alexa O'Brien of the investigation called The Most Militarized Universities in America. And you'll find a link to read that article. There are a number of also charts and infographics. You can find a link at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. And today we're talking about the U.S. military, including some of the surprising places where the armed forces is cultivating the leadership and fighting forces of the future. Later on, we're going to hear some of the reasons why the military is struggling to retain and recruit top talent. This next story comes from Roman Mars of 99% Invisible, and it's about some of the unlikely heroes of World War II, a group that you might not even think of as soldiers, but one that played a pivotal role in helping to win the war.
In the 1940s, there were, as there are today, a lot of great art and design schools in New York City. And there were then, as there are today, a lot of young, talented artists and designers at those schools.
But in the 1940s, there was something else that some of those artists and designers had to do first.
That's our own Katie Mingle.
There was a war going on, World War II, and the Army needed artists because, well, they had kind of a crazy idea.
The crazy idea was this. The United States Army would design a deception unit, a unit that would appear to the enemy to be a large armored division. Thousands of soldiers, tanks, trucks, guns. Only this unit would actually be equipped with fake tanks, fake trucks, fake guns, and manned by just a handful of soldiers.
The so-called Ghost Army would impersonate a larger armored division. Rick Beyer has a forthcoming book about all of this and also made a film about it called The Ghost Army.
You want to make it seem like something is there that isn't there. And if you want people to do that, you're going to want artists.
The Army was interested in recruiting people with art, with an art background. We were going to do installations of sorts.
That's Jack Macy.
I was an art major, which is why during World War II, I got picked for the Ghost Army.
So young Jack is shipped off to Europe to join the camouflage unit, where he discovers that a lot of the other guys in his unit are also artists.
A good 50%, we'll say.
And one of the things all of those artists had been working on was designing fake tanks and trucks.
And so that's when I discovered my first inflatable tank.
Inflatable rubber tanks were a crucial part of the visual deception unit.
But the visual deception unit had more than just tanks.
Virtually every kind of vehicle the Army has, the Ghost Army had inflatable versions of.
This stuff was all meant to be believable from a distance, for planes flying overhead or maybe people looking through binoculars. And at a distance, the inflatables were super realistic.
The whole point of the Ghost Army was to make sure their presence was known. The Ghost Army needed to be seen and heard and perceived by the Germans as being real.
Which brings us to the deception unit that I probably would have been drafted into, Sonic Deception.
So they would record the sounds of tanks going down roads or the sounds of trucks of men reaching a certain point and all the men jumping out, and then be able to play them back in such a way as to make the enemy think that those things are really happening.
The speakers could project sound as far as 15 miles, and there was a huge library of sounds to choose from. For example, engines make different sounds depending on the terrain, and they had all of those different kinds of sounds.
People who heard this say that it was unbelievably eerie, that it was so realistic that you started seeing vehicles that weren't there.
The third component of the Ghost Army were the radio operators. It was well known that the Germans listened in on radio communications of Allied troops. So if the Ghost Army was trying to impersonate a real armored division, they'd have to send the right kinds of transmissions.
All of the units paid incredible attention to detail, but the radio operators had to be perfect mimics. They had to learn the exact keystrokes of an individual Morse code operator in the unit they were impersonating.
And if you don't do that, the German intercept person listening is going to think, well, wait a minute, is that really from the 4th Armored Division?
Over the course of the war, the Ghost Army lost 3 soldiers and had several dozen wounded. But overall, it was one of the safer assignments of World War II.
And the Germans never caught on to the Ghost Army.
Victory by deception.
And that story was produced by Katie Mingle and Roman Mars of 99% Invisible. Earlier in the show, we heard about the military's significant investment in colleges and universities training people for jobs related to America's new national security strategy, like information technology, intelligence, cybersecurity, and big data analytics. The military needs troops, sure, but also workers who are skilled in those fields. And they have a lot of options to choose from, including hotshot companies that offer gourmet meals and gyms and telecommuting. The Pentagon is not known for its flexibility and is having trouble attracting and keeping experienced soldiers to work up the chain to become officers and high-level thinkers and strategists to lead 21st century conflicts. Nora Ben-Sahel is a scholar who has worked with and written about the military, and David Barno is a retired Army officer who had overall command of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Together, they are researching and advising on how to best prepare the U.S. military for the future. They wrote about their research in an article called "Can the U.S. Military Halt Its Brain Drain for the Atlantic?" And Nora Ben-Sahel, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you for having us.
And David, thank you for being with us.
Great to be here.
Now, I'm going to just ask it to either of you. You can pick up where you want to. But, you know, Ash Carter, he's been speaking to audiences all about this. But he began this initiative, Force of the Future, at a Philadelphia high school. Why there?
Because it was his alma mater. He went back to his high school for one of the first speeches after he became Secretary of Defense. And Ash Carter has a background in technology. He's a nuclear physicist by training and had been in charge of Pentagon technical acquisition in one of his previous jobs. But what he highlighted there is that the people in the military matter the most, that the people are the relative advantage that the United States has. And so he announced a very broad-ranging initiative to try to improve the military personnel system, as well as the civilian personnel system within the Department of Defense, in order to try to modernize a personnel system that really has its roots in the industrial era and hasn't changed all that much since after World War II.
Well, it is a really interesting choice, given that all we have heard about Carter and his propensity or his understanding of technology, and all that we hear and have just heard about the conflicts of the future being fought in cyberspace, aided by analysis of data, tracking down and targeting adversaries, and abetted by drones. So suddenly the shift is to the people. Is this overdue?
I think so, and I think Carter would say there's a war for talent out there and that the military and the Defense Department have to compete for the very best and brightest minds and the most motivated and well-educated young people that the rest of American private sector and industry is trying to get to work for them. And so understanding what it takes to bring those people into the military, find who they are, recruit them, and then get them to stay, in many cases, for a career of perhaps 20 or 30 years, he realizes that's going to be an immense challenge in a world of Google and Microsoft and Apple and other companies where upward mobility is very rapid, where individuals can, you know, do very innovative, high-impact things at a very young age. And he realizes that's what's going to win the future wars. Everyone's going to have access to the same technology, whether they steal it or they develop it themselves. And what's going to turn the corner to be successful for this nation will be having the best people to be able to rapidly adapt and be able to prevail in those conflicts.
Well, help us better understand how the personnel system currently works. Now, it is a closed-loop system for talent, you say in your article, based on this up-or-out kind of method of promotion. How does it work? How does it not work?
Basically, it says that someone in the military has a certain amount of time they can spend in their rank, whether that's on the enlisted side or as an officer, and if they don't get promoted by a certain point, they are forced out of the military. The promotion rates vary depending on which rank you're talking about, but it is one of the ways that they keep people moving through the system. The problem with that is that it sort of forces everybody into the same types of experiences. It's also combined with a culture where you have to command troops in order to advance. And when you put those two things together, the incentives are very much for people to follow the same exact paths because they're all competing against each other for promotion to try to get the same types of command slots and other things that are needed for promotion. The system does not enable people to spend more time at one rank or in a particular job. People are rotating through jobs very quickly. The basic idea is that it treats people as interchangeable parts without taking as much time to think about their individual talents and skills and trying to match those to jobs. And that is causing many people to have great frustration over their careers, a feeling of a lack of control and a sense of bureaucracy that doesn't take advantage of their skills when they don't get jobs that play to their strengths and they see someone else in that job who would rather not be doing it.
Yeah, one of the quotes you have, somebody who heads up the Defense Department's Personnel and Readiness Office, describing the military personnel system as a Polaroid in the age of digital cameras, once on the cutting edge, now superseded. Is senior military acknowledging or aware of the problem?
I think that's a mixed report. One of the interesting things that's apparent to us as we did our research here, and we've had some interviews and discussions since then, is that the senior military, the generals and the admirals who run the uniform military, they're all products of this system. So inevitably, they're going to look at their own career path and they'll look at a system that selected them to be the chief of staff of the Army or be the commander of U.S. Central Command as a very legitimate, successful system because they're the output of that system. But there's also, I think, a sizable number that realize that the generation that's leading the military now, the baby boomers for the most part, and the beginnings of Generation X, that this new generation, the millennial generation, which my sons and my daughter are part of, that they have different outlooks, they have different things that they value. They're not going to necessarily stay in for a 30-year career if they don't have more input to their jobs and they don't have the ability to actually see things that they're good at be what they find their career path leaning towards. So there's a growing sense, and there needs to be some reforms here.
Mm-hmm. I think something that's important to note is the types of reforms that we're talking about and that Secretary Carter is likely to introduce are not just designed to make people feel good about their careers. We're talking about reforms that will help the best and the brightest stay in, but also benefit the entire force by providing a diversity of backgrounds and viewpoints, people who have different career experiences, so that you get around the problem of groupthink that can emerge where all of your commanders have checked all of the same boxes on their promotion path. I think that's the part that's hardest for the senior leadership sometimes to absorb,
mm-hmm.
Because they see this as pandering to millennials. And, you know, we've heard from some individuals during our research calling people who get out of the military because they want more flexibility selfish and not dedicated to the service. We think that's fundamentally wrong, and that what the military needs for the future is going to involve the skills and attributes that these people have. It's not just about making millennials feel better. It's about the needs of the force and the ability of the United States military to fight and win in its future wars.
Right. I can imagine that, the sort of idea of, like, I had to take my knocks coming up, you should as well. I mean, we've all heard these kind of complaints about millennials at work, whether they are fair or accurate or not. You know, they feel entitled. They want to be congratulated for everything they do. They don't want to work outside of their job description or comfort zone. Very different expectations than baby boomers. Now, what would it take to change that system? And is it even compatible with a job that involves risks to life and limb?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that the same group of millennials for the last 15 years has been volunteering to come into a military that's at war, and many of them have been deploying to Iraq and Afghanistan over and over again if they've stayed in the military during this period of time. So many of the things that we kind of stereotypically push as characteristics of all millennials may not apply to the people that are in the military. Some of them certainly do. They absolutely are interested in the values of family. They're interested in job satisfaction more than compensation. But there are also some big differences here in the fact that they're willing to go into harm's way, put their life on the line, you know, put their families on hold year after year while they deploy into combat zones. And the military certainly doesn't want to lose that, but it ought to be able to make modifications to a system built for the late 20th century to make sure it keeps these incredible people in and gives them some of the things they're looking for with a bit more flexibility and a bit more input into their careers.
We're talking about the future of the U.S. fighting force. Many millennials are not joining up because talented, bright people are being lured away by tech companies with perks from organic food to exercise programs. And many people are leaving the military service because there isn't a lot of movement or flexibility. We're talking with David Barno and Nora Bensahel, who've been researching this problem and wrote about whether the U.S. military can halt its brain drain for The Atlantic. Well, the military doesn't do exit interviews, so we don't really have a sense of the level of quality of those who are leaving. But you profiled several people. Caitlin Van Dam, she flew attack helicopters as a Marine in Afghanistan, now a grad student. Tyler Jost, a couple of other people who've left. Why did they leave?
Well, I think one good news story is that the Defense Department has now decided it's going to mandate exit interviews for people that are leaving. It's part of Carter's reform initiatives that are now starting to roll out. In the case of Katie Van Dam and Tyler Jost, they both left for diverse reasons, as everyone does, that had to do with limits within their particular career paths and their ability to have input into what they were going to do next. But both of them also were keenly interested in going to graduate school and doing it, you know, in their 30s instead of in their 40s or not at all. And the opportunities, in their view, to be able to do that inside the military without jeopardizing their career path was a zero-sum game. If they gave up those years, there's a pretty good chance that they weren't going to be able to make some of those, you know, inflexible gates for promotion and for command. So they found that, you know, in their view, the best thing to do was to either move out completely, which Tyler did out of the Army and is now getting a PhD at Harvard in Mandarin and Chinese and in international relations. And Katie, now a Marine Corps Reserve officer, part-time officer in the Marines, and getting a graduate degree in international relations. So that was a critical thing for them, and they didn't think they'd be able to do that inside the military.
And these people have talents and skills that, if, you know, I think they would have liked to stay in if they had had some more flexibility and diverse career path options. The case of Tyler, I think, is particularly striking because here is someone who served in commanded a cyber unit, is almost fluent in Mandarin, and was accepted to some of the nation's top graduate programs to study the Chinese military. He chose to go to Harvard, where he is getting his PhD now. That's the type of skill set that if someone has those capabilities and interests, you can see the benefit to the force over the long term. Mm-hmm. It's a real detriment to the force that someone with his skills and his interest is now pursuing them outside the military rather than choosing to stay in, where their skills could be so incredibly valuable.
Isn't it to be expected, though, after announced withdrawals in important combat zones, Iraq and Afghanistan, and more than a decade of conflict, that people do leave the service?
Well, they're always going to be leaving. The military needs to shed people. It can't simply bring all these people in each year, which are literally hundreds of thousands, and then keep them, you know, for 20 or 30 years. That wouldn't be healthy for the force. It is a pyramid type of a system. But the critical question for officers, and we focused on, you know, whether the right people are staying, whether the military even knows if, on a performance, you know, scale, if the top 20% are leaving and the bottom 20% are staying and those in between are mixed. And that's not to say that's the case, but the military doesn't know if that's true or not, or if the reverse is true, the best are staying and the worst are leaving. So a degree of measurement and understanding and assessment of data of who are your best performers and how are those different 20% staying or leaving the force and why are they staying or leaving, that's critical because you know, 25 years from now, 35 years from now, you want to have the very best people leading the force, and they're not going to be arriving, you know, laterally at that point in time. They're going to be growing up from lieutenants and captains and lieutenant commanders here today in the services. So I think that's the critical thing we're arguing. It shouldn't just be about the numbers. The military is very focused on the personnel system and just keeping enough numbers to keep the system moving upward. They need to focus on who those numbers are and measuring what degree of skills and talent they have.
I'm wondering, David and Nora, you've heard the announcements by the Department of Defense, how they plan to change the personnel system. Are you optimistic about the force of the future?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this initiative is coming at exactly the right time, and it's meeting a need that's been out there for a number of years in young officers who are struggling to make the decision to stay in a military that they're very committed to and dedicated to continue to wear a uniform and serve the nation. But they can't do that if it conflicts with their family's goals, with their spouse's goals, with their ability to fit into jobs that are meaningful for them. So this is an incredibly timely initiative, and I applaud Secretary Carter for taking this on really literally from his first day in office, that this was going to be one of his early going priorities. So it couldn't come at a better time, and I think it's a much needed potential fix for a problem that's been out there for a long, long time, and it's going to keep far better numbers of people that the military absolutely needs to lead it in the future in the force now.
I agree with all of that. I'm a little less optimistic. Maybe I'm a little bit more cynical by nature, but there are incredible bureaucratic forces that are aligned against some of these reforms. The system is very, very entrenched within the Department of Defense, with legions of staff people who are very invested in the current system. And, you know, as we all know, bureaucracies and large organizations resist change. You know, Secretary Carter only has a limited time in office, presuming that the new president, whoever that is in 2017, will pick a new Secretary of Defense. So I think these are all the right ideas. I think they're vitally important. I'm a little more concerned that the bureaucratic forces in the Defense Department and some of the lobbying on Capitol Hill, because some of these reforms will take congressional action, that there will be interests mobilized against some of these reforms just because organizations don't like change.
Well, Nora, David, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Nora Bensahel, she's a scholar who's worked with and written about the military, and David Barno, retired Army officer. They are currently working together to research and advise how to best prepare the U.S. military for the future. You can read their complete article, Can the U.S. Military Halt Its Brain Drain? From The Atlantic. There's a link at wordofmouthradio.org. People often call Vietnam the first televised war and credit press coverage with shaping public opinion and even the outcome of the conflict. In this piece from Backstory with the American History Guys, we're going to hear about how, decades after Vietnam, the Pentagon shifted policy, hoping to better control the narrative of war. The hosts of Backstory are Brian Ballow, Ed Ayers, and Peter Onuf.
In the fall of 1990, Joe Galloway was gearing up to cover the first Gulf War for the U.S. News and World Report. He was about to leave for Saudi Arabia when he received the Pentagon's new set of rules for wartime journalists.
The rules ran 36 pages, double-sided, small type. And if those rules were followed, you couldn't cover anything or report anything.
Galloway was shocked. He'd been a reporter during the Vietnam War when the military's guidelines ran just one page.
Vietnam, in fact, was the most openly and freely covered war in the history of our country.
The Pentagon trusted reporters would not reveal any information that might compromise national security. There were no military censors.
Movement was never limited for me. I went wherever I wanted to go and generally was welcomed at the other end by the soldiers that I was covering.
Dan Hallin, a communications professor at UC San Diego, says this press freedom created a myth by the end of the Vietnam War.
I mean, there's different versions of this idea, but the U.S. lost the war in Vietnam because it lost its will to win, and that was the responsibility of the media. That was due to media coverage of the war. That's a view that developed after the war.
Galloway insists the press never had that much influence.
I wish that I could have written a story so powerful that it would have driven us out of that war, in which case there would only be 1,100 names on that black granite wall in Washington, D.C., instead of 58,290. what really turned public opinion in Vietnam was not what they saw on television and on the evening news. What it was an absolutely endless flow of bright, shiny aluminum body containers flying home to every little town in America.
But Allen says the myth became conventional wisdom within the Pentagon. When the U.S. military started planning for the next wars,
they took the attitude that media coverage inevitably means the decline of public support for a war, and therefore you have to restrict the media as much as possible.
And so, during the first Gulf War, the Pentagon relied on press pools, small groups of journalists who were granted permission to cover the same event. And the U.S. military decided where to send those journalists.
And for the most part, the pools were not sent to where the fighting was actually going on. So most journalists had the experience that, you know, they missed that war, essentially, that they were back in the hotel and not where actual fighting was going on.
As a result, reporters found themselves censored ahead of time.
I mean, the journalists can't get there to report the story to begin with. They don't even need to censor them because they don't have anything, you know, substantial to report.
And there was another problem with the pool system. Even journalists who got good access to combat zones still lived in the shadow of Vietnam. John Fialka, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal during the Gulf War, recalls reporters with access to a military helicopter during battle. They witnessed the Army's flanking maneuver that would ultimately decide the war.
And they got back to an airfield where they found one phone, and there was a line of soldiers calling home to say, "Hi, Mom, I'm okay." And the officer in charge of minding the reporters decided to put them in the back of the line, first telling them how much he hated reporters. There was just a lot of sort of gratuitous hatred spewing out of a war that happened 20 years previously. And in the end, a lot of the copy, a lot of the videotape, a lot of the pictures got delayed to the point where nobody ever saw it.
Fialka says the news business is like the milk business. It has to be fresh. Editors would likely dump reports of three-day-old battles.
The news of the war is the first draft of history. If the first draft has big holes in it or is censored or whatever, then you have tampered with your own history.
And when the Pentagon went back to review these first drafts of the history, military officials noticed something missing, namely the war.
You know, I went to conferences after the war where they put the generals on one side of the table and us on the other. And one of the generals started complaining, and I said, "Where were your pool journalists?" He said, "Oh, I locked them up in the rear at headquarters and didn't bring them forward." And I said, "Now you're complaining you have no film of your great successes on the battlefield? Whose fault is it?"
Determined to learn from their mistake, the Pentagon sought a new strategy for wars that were to follow.
The solution was the embed system, which attached reporters to military units inside combat zones. It gave more journalists more access than press pools. Embedding journalists in military units also kept them safe in increasingly dangerous war zones. Most news organizations have depended on the system since the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003. Still, Hallin notes that the embed system is simply another form of censorship, rather than a return to the open coverage of Vietnam.
Most news organizations were aware that the policy of embedding was good at giving them access, but would give them a limited view of what was actually going on because, you know, they'd be accompanying U.S. troops and they'd be reporting things essentially from the point of view of U.S. troops.
And those limits matter in a democracy. Fialka says that the press needs to be able to report on a war as freely and openly as possible.
The public pays billions of dollars for these episodes, and they should understand how they work and how they don't work. And it really is in the military's interests to get the truth out there, because they're representing a country that puts a great deal of value in the First Amendment.
And that piece was produced by Backstory with the American History Guys. You'll find a link to hear more from that episode at wordofmouthradio.org. Thanks so much for your listening time today. There is much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. And if you missed any of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There is a link to subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, rate it. Tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 with more Word of Mouth here on New Hampshire Public Radio.